Prologue. On a warm spring evening, just before Easter 1927, people who lived in tall buildings in New York were given pause when wooden scaffolding around the tower of the brand new Sherry Netherland apartment hotel caught fire, and it became evident that the city's firemen lacked any means to get water to such a height. Crowds flocked to Fifth Avenue to watch the blaze, the biggest the city had seen in years. At 38 stories, the Sherry Netherland was the tallest residential building ever erected, and the scaffolding, put there to facilitate the final stages of construction, covered the top 15 stories, providing enough wood to make a giant blaze around its summit. From a distance, the building looked rather like a just-struck match. The flames were visible 20 miles away. Up close, the scene was much more dramatic. Sections of burning scaffolding up to 50 feet long fell from a height of 500 feet and crashed in clattering showers of sparks in the streets below, to the gleeful cries of the spectators and the peril of toiling firemen. Burning embers dropped onto the roofs of neighboring buildings, setting four of them alight. Firemen trained their hoses on the Sherry Netherland building, but it was a token gesture, since their streams could not rise above the third or fourth story. Fortunately, the building was unfinished and therefore unoccupied. People in 1920s America were unusually drawn to spectacle, and by 10 p.m. the crowd had grown to an estimated 100,000 people, an enormous gathering for a spontaneous event. 700 policemen had to be brought in to keep order. Some wealthy observers, deflected from their evening revels, took rooms in the Plaza Hotel across the street and held impromptu fire room parties, according to the New York Times. Mayor Jimmy Walker turned up to have a look and got soaked when he wandered into the path of a hose. A moment later, a flaming 10-foot-long plank crashed onto the pavement near him, and he accepted advice to withdraw. The fire did extensive damage to the upper reaches of the building, but luckily did not spread downwards and burned itself out about midnight. The flames and smoke provided some welcome diversion to two men, Clarence Chamberlain and Bert Acosta, who had been flying in circles in a small plane above Roosevelt Field on Long Island since 9:30 that morning. They were doing so in an attempt to break the world endurance record set 2 years earlier by two French aviators. This was partly a matter of national honor. America, birthplace of aviation, was now hopelessly behind even the smallest European nations, and partly to confirm that planes could stay up long enough to make long-distance flights. The trick of the exercise, Chamberlain explained afterwards, was to squeeze maximum mileage out of the plane by adjusting the throttle and fuel mixture to the point where the plane was just able to remain airborne, keeping it on starvation rations, as Chamberlain put it. When he and Acosta finally glided back to Earth, shortly before 1 o'clock in the afternoon of their third day aloft, they were essentially flying on vapor. They had been continuously airborne for 51 hours, 11 minutes, and 25 seconds, an advance of nearly 6 hours on the existing record. They emerged grinning from their plane to the approving roar of a large crowd. People really did gather in enormous numbers for almost any event in the 1920s. The two triumphant pilots were tired and stiff, and very thirsty. It turned out that one of their ground crew, in a moment of excited distraction, had left their canteens filled with soapy water, so they had had nothing to drink for 2 days. Otherwise, the flight was a great success, great enough to be the main story in the New York Times on Good Friday, April 15th. Across three columns, the headline declared, "Flyers set record of 51 hours in air, day and night without food or water. Land worn, but eager for Paris flight." They had flown 4,100 miles, 500 miles more than the distance from New York to Paris. Just as significantly, they had managed to get airborne with 375 gallons of fuel, an enormous load for the time, and had used up just 1,200 feet of runway to do so. All this was extremely encouraging for those who wished to fly the Atlantic, and in the spring of 1927 there were many, like Chamberlain and Acosta, who most assuredly did. By a curiously ironic twist, the event that left America far behind the rest of the world in aviation was the very one that assured its dominance in so many other spheres, the First World War. Before 1914, airplanes barely featured in military thinking. The French Air Corps, with 36 planes, was larger than all the other air forces in the world put together. Germany, Britain, Italy, Russia, Japan, and Austria all had no more than 4 planes in their fleets. The United States had just 2. But with the outbreak of fighting, military commanders quickly saw how useful planes could be. For monitoring enemy troop movements, for directing artillery fire, and above all, for providing a new direction and manner in which to kill people. In the early days, bombs often were nothing more than wine bottles filled with gasoline or kerosene, with a simple detonator attached, though a few pilots threw hand grenades, and some for a time dropped specially made darts called flechettes, which could pierce a helmet or otherwise bring pain and consternation to those in the trenches below. As always, where killing is involved, technological progress was swift, and by 1918, aerial bombs of up to 2,200 pounds were being dropped. Germany alone rained down 1 million individual bombs, some 27,000 tons of explosives, in the course of the war. Bombing was not terribly accurate. A bomb dropped from 10,000 feet rarely hit its target, and often missed by 0.5 mile or more. But the psychological effect, wherever a large bomb fell, was considerable. Heavy bomb loads required planes of ever greater size and power, which in turn spurred the development of swifter, nimbler fighter craft to defend or attack them, which in further turn produced the celebrated dogfights that fired the imaginations of schoolboys and set the tone for aviation for a generation to come. The air war produced an insatiable need for planes. In 4 years, the 4 main combatant nations spent $1 billion, a staggering sum, nearly all borrowed from America, on their air fleets. From almost nothing, France in 4 years built up an aircraft industry that employed nearly 200,000 people and produced some 70,000 planes. Britain built 55,000 planes, Germany 48,000, and Italy 20,000. Quite an advance, bearing in mind that only a few years earlier, the entire world aviation industry consisted of 2 brothers in a bicycle shop in Ohio. Up to 1914, the total number of people in the world who had been killed in airplanes was about 100. Now men died in their thousands. By the spring of 1917, the life expectancy of a British pilot was put at 8 days. Altogether, between 30,000 and 40,000 flyers were killed or injured to the point of incapacity in 4 years. Training was not a great deal safer than combat. At least 15,000 men were killed or invalided in accidents in flight schools. American flyers were particularly disadvantaged. When the United States entered the war in April 1917, not a single American military official had ever even seen a fighter aircraft, much less commanded one.